The way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced, thousands of books have been written, and yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is. And that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I'm so glad to have you here today. I want to give a special shout out today to an old friend who I met back when I was a teenager in Civil Air Patrol. And I was studying to be a pilot when I was a teenager. And I'm not going to disclose his name, but he knows who he is. What are we doing today? I have a new website, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention in case it slipped slipped off the radar for you somehow. It's galacticroundtable.co. And the purpose of this website is to teach people how to make contact with ET. Some of you out there make contact every single night. You go out in the yard and the blinky lights are there and you tell them in your mind, move left, move right, and they do, you know, all that, and you go out every night to say hi to your friends. There's etheric contact and there's physical contact, and this website is designed to help people learn how to do both. So I've laid out a pretty simple plan, and I'm offering classes there. So for those of you who'd like to go deeper in your experience, I encourage you to check that out. The first class is April 16th if you're interested in signing up. It's coming up pretty soon. So, as you know, every day we've been looking at the witnesses that will be at the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, April 29th to May 3rd at the National Press Club. And the other thing I want to do now is invite you, if you haven't already, to buy your access pass to the webcast. It's great if people know that the Citizens Hearing is happening, but it's even more important to encourage people to watch it as it's happening. So the purchase price is $3.80. It's being offered in English, Spanish, Arabic, Japanese, Hindi, and they're going to translate it into Mandarin Chinese for the web archive. And when you purchase the access pass for the week, you will also included are the lectures in the evenings. So what happens is if you click on English, you'll be taken to a PayPal page, and there you can pay with your bank bank account, credit card, or your PayPal account, and you get charged $3.80, and then immediately you get a link into your email. And so you can mark that link in your email, in your inbox. And then during the week, when it's appearing live, you just go back to the link in your inbox and click on it. It'll take you right to the live stream. So, you know, when you're at work in your little cubicle, plug in your headphones and click on the link, and you can listen in the background while you're doing your work. So I think it would be great if you go ahead and buy that in advance and get it ready and tell all your friends. Okay, so remember, everybody, we've been reviewing these witnesses, and I told you, I warned you that I would say, this is my favorite one every single day. You know, this is my favorite one. This is my favorite one. I have another one today that it is my favorite one. We are going to take a look at Major Milton Torres. I'm not sure. I don't want to share too much. Let me see what it has to say about him on his page. Dr. Torres won't actually be at the hearing testifying. He will, Jeffrey Torres will be there for him. And I'm not sure what the incident is, why he won't be traveling there. I'm not really sure. I tried to track down the reason, and I'll let you know. It says Milton Torres was born on July 28, 1931, in New York City, but moved to Miami, Florida at age 15. He joined the U.S. Air Force in 1951 and was commissioned as a lieutenant in 1954, serving in Great Britain as a fighter pilot. In 1961, he earned a Bachelor's of Science degree in engineering and became a range control officer at Cape Canaveral AFS for the Gemini and Apollo space programs. Later, he flew 276 combat missions in the Vietnam War and earned 13 air medals, including the Distinguished Flying Cross. He attained the rank of major before retiring from military service in 1971. After leaving the military, he earned a doctorate degree in mechanical engineering and became an engineering professor at Florida International University. He retired from the university in 2004. Torres wrote a novel in 2005 titled The Good Guys Wear Blue Hats, based partly on his own experience in the military and working with NASA. Dr. Torres, back in 1957, I think it was, as United States Air Force pilot, came into contact with a UFO. And back in 2010... When the UK released all their files, that's when he felt free to start to talk about this. And the piece I want to share with you is about, it's at the X conferences where Nick Pope, remember Nick Pope from the UK, the DOD guy, interviewed Dr. Torres and let him tell his story. And there's a couple of pieces in this video where his voice is a little bit hard to understand a couple of times, just briefly. It appears when he's talking on the video, maybe he had a stroke or something, but this guy is, his story is so neat. The way he tells it, a couple of times during the interview, he says, let me make a long story short, but he never makes it short. It's really great. I'll just let you listen to it and see what I'm talking about. Here we go. This is Nick Pope at the X conferences introducing Dr. Torres. Okay, we're going to have to listen to this advertisement. There's a lot of ads in this piece, and they might interrupt us, so bear with me. It's loading, I guess. It looks like we're experiencing some technical difficulties, but just give it a second.
everything else in his airplane worked, but I think it was his fire control.
This is the story of Thomas and the alternate universe. Every evening at exactly 6:07,
his air-to-air missile firing capability just winked out. Parviz Jafari retired as a general. There are generals out there willing to talk about the UFO issue and about first-person experiences. Another case is Comandante Huertas from Peru, 1980. In December, he was scrambled, authorized to open fire on a UFO that had infringed into restricted military airspace. He actually did manage to open fire with his machine cannon. His testimony was that the rounds were somehow absorbed by the UFO. He said, "I didn't miss." You know, like all fighter pilots, proud men, he said, "I didn't miss. Nor did I see the rounds ricochet off this thing. They were absorbed." He said, "That's the only word I can use." There is mainstream media coverage of this. Major Torres was interviewed widely, and this whole issue of incidents where pilots have been scrambled to intercept UFOs tracked on radar and given orders to open fire was covered, for example, recently on America's Newsroom on Fox News. So the big channels are beginning to take a look at this subject, and I'm in the second part of my presentation. I'm going to perhaps touch a little bit on changes that I have noticed in the way in which the mainstream media are beginning to engage on this UFO issue. But I want to return now to the ongoing situation in the United Kingdom, where I feel that the British are leading the way, both in terms of governmental action to release our archive of UFO files, and indeed in terms of the events themselves, because Britain has had, as I'm going to go on and explain, a series of extremely interesting UFO incidents in the last year or so. And I'm going to briefly touch on that, but I want, and Steve Bassett specifically asked that I perhaps leave some time for questions at the end. So I'm going to go through these sort of reasonably quickly. But on 8th of June 2008, there was a reported near miss between a UFO and a police helicopter near an Air Force base called RAF St. Athan in South Wales. Reports of what happened varied, but basically one media report suggested that the pilots then chased this UFO across the Bristol Channel. The police themselves confirmed that a UFO had been seen by the air crew. They denied that a chase had taken place. There's a lot of bureaucratic wrangling between the police and the Ministry of Defence over who was going to take the lead on this issue. And there was a one...
Okay, everybody. I have to apologize. With all the mix-up when I was reloading this page, I brought you in on the wrong spot. So let's take this back. Just took me a minute to figure it out. Here we go. There's going to be another ad. Bear with me. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hi, I'm Susanna. Save the best.
Okay.
To hand over to Major Milton Torres.
Okay. I hope you can hear me. This man just saved my life. The MOD released the story that I've kept since 1957. What a relief. I can talk about it. I'll give you a background about where I came from and how I started. I joined the Air Force because
The Korean War was on, and my number was getting close. And I certainly didn't want to go to the Army. And I don't like mud. And I just sure as hell wanted to be a firefighter. And I knew I wasn't going to be one because I didn't have any education at that time. But anyway, I joined the Air Force. And lo and behold, they come down and say, we offer to the enlisted personnel a chance to fly. Wow. You couldn't give me more money or more grace than to be a fighter pilot. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot. Well, when I got into fighters, or I should say when I got into training, I decided I was going to go for the fighters. I wanted to fly an F-86 and go to Korea and shoot down all those goddamn MiGs that everybody else was missing. Anyway, make a long story short, I succeeded. I was well up in the top of the class. I wasn't the top, but I was close. And they offered me a fighter job. It was an F-86. But an F-86, not for Korea, was an 86D, an all-weather airplane, to shoot down bombers that were coming in. Well, at the same time, high-level discussions were held in the Air Force, and they said, we're going to send this F-86D to England. We're going to augment their defense capabilities just in case. So they took an entire wing. A wing consists of basically three squadrons of fighters. That's about 75 fighters.
Another ad. This one is filled with ads. Bear with me.
And they sent me to England, RAF Station Manston. And boy, that was a great, great thing. I had been watching J. Arthur Rank movies since I was a kid. And I knew that I was going to love England. So there I go. So I was afraid to go to England and meet some of those old spinsters that J. Arthur Rank used to put up for her movies. And so I said, I better get married. So I married my bride, and that was way back in 1954. Excuse me. Yes, 54 is when I married her. I also went to England in 54. They sent me directly to England with my wife. At any rate, one of the things that I can say, when I went to England, it was just exactly the way they described it in J. Arthur Rank. I mean, I was issued currency that was pounds and sterling, and some of them were printed on only one side in black, a five-pound note. And everybody that I would go to cash this five-pound note would have me sign the damn thing on the back. Unbelievable. I didn't understand that. But I got the pounds, shillings, and pence down, and I really enjoyed England. Like you wouldn't believe, I had two children there. Anyway, make a long story short, we were assigned to the 514th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, one of the three squadrons of the wing. And this were all stationed at RAF Station Manson, except we had one squadron up at Bentwaters. And it eventually went to Schusterberg, I think it was, but wherever. Didn't matter. That was after. We had gone down to rocketry at Wheelis Air Force Base in Libya, and I learned all about Islamic living and what have you from Wheelis going around there. I made the mistake of taking a picture of a, it looked like the thief of Baghdad, you know. Oh, I don't know what he was, but I took his picture, and the next thing I know, he screams, holy murder. And I didn't know what the hell I'd done. I just took his picture. And that was what I had done. I had taken his picture. I captured his soul. So I didn't know any better. But next thing I know, I have about 30 or 40 people around me. And being used to the military, and especially the British military, I was in Libya, in Tripoli. And I was right in front of the seaside there, right next to the British Officers Club. And thank God for that, because out comes this MP, a military police from the British Air Force Army, and he says, I said, he says, you're having a bit of trouble here? I said, yes. I said, I took this man's picture. I didn't ask his permission or anything like this. I didn't think I was doing anything. He says, oh, you don't have to know how to handle these blighters. So I said, fine, you take over. He dispersed the crowd. He told him to get out of there, and that was the end of that. I went in and had a drink with the man, and I don't drink. And I was so grateful for the assistance, you know, because I had seen some weird things from Islamics, the Arabs. They would look. We were flying against rocketry, against a rag that they had behind the bomber. The bomber would go out and fly in rectangular circles so that we could go and fire from the radar on this rag. And anyway, make a long story short, that when the rag would fall down, sometimes it would float, and it would float over the base, and sometimes part of it would hang over the fence, and the Arabs would try to steal it, because anything they could get is their money in the bank. So anyway, make a long story short, we got so well proficient with rocketry that they made us what they call combat ready. When we went back to England, they decided that the 514th and the 513th, that's just a squadron on the base, were combat ready, and we would take our share of the load for alerts. Now, we shared that alert with the British, the RAF. Now, in the case of Manston, first of all, let me explain. Manston is on the Thames estuary, on the tip, just north of Dover, but on the Thames estuary. And we could see France, about 18 miles on a clear day, which wasn't very often, but we could see it. So we decided to set up shop on the end of the runway on the side. Now, Manston has a 750-foot wide runway. It was made for recovery of bombers that were shot up during the war. And boy, they had they had a FIDO system, they had everything that you could possibly have. The FIDO system would burn the fog off. It would lift the fog up 300-400 feet. That'd give you a hell of a lot of visibility. So it was really the perfect base for an all-weather fighter. Anyway, it was my turn to go and be a alert pilot. Now, mind you, I was just a lieutenant. I was not very long in the Air Force. I had maybe a year or two underneath me. We had rocketry, and we were combat ready. So the next thing I know, we're out there on the alert shack, two airplanes, myself and my wingman, were there next to each other, and we had a rule. First one to the airplane was leave in this particular case. Anyway, sure enough, we got the clocks in the scramble order. They said, get your planes, get airborne, and check in on whatever the frequency was. It's not important. Roger, we beat that 5 minutes in about 3 minutes at least. And we were on the end of the runway. I was taking off. I was no sooner got airborne. Now, mind you, we took off as a formation of two, but because of our tactics, in radar, one drops behind the other, and we go in line. And then as we reach the target, whatever the target is, we turn in place so that both of us have a chance to fire on the same thing. Well, at any rate, when I checked into
At BookIt.com, we think booking travel should be fun. That's why BookIt.com is so...
PCI, this is... I have some information for you. I says, I hope so. He says, you are ordered to fire on this object. It's a UFO that's orbiting Ipswich and Norwich, which is on the East Anglia. And it's just stationary sometimes. We don't understand it. It's at Angels 320. So, and it's at Go Gate, which means you have to burn it. Just go get it. So we got out there, and mind you, he wasn't lying. We were in the soup immediately. I don't think I ever saw a single light after we got airborne. But I was in that soup, and he directed us to North 020, which is kind of back. So we turned around. We were probably over France by this time. And then we turned around and started heading and climbing. I was climbing as fast as the airplane would go using the afterburner. And my fuel was going fast. Because, you know, when you use that afterburner, the fuel disappears. Anyway, he said, I'll give you an intern, and you'll have on your port side at 30 degrees, somewhere around 15 miles away, you'll have your target. Sure enough, just like he said, we turned. I saw a blip that was as big as the blips I saw. Someone had seen an aircraft carrier in the North Sea. Of course, I couldn't see anything. I could get it on the radar. And the radar was so sensitive that it was like a blob of light. It wasn't a point. It was a blob. So when I ran my range gate marker up to this blip, it just seemed to lock on and turn all the lights off. It was such a strong lock on that the airplane was telling me where to go. I mean, just in every way. So sure enough, I called Judy. That was the symbol that we used for GCI and saying, you don't need to give me any more information. I'm locked on. And that my radar will take me into this thing. Well,
I don't want to interrupt this guy, but I didn't get this the first time I was listening. The UFO was as big as an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean Sea. That's what he's describing.
Well, I was still at 0.92 and fuel was going down fast. And I said, I want to come out of afterburner. I said, no, stay in afterburner. I was really worried about my fuel. Anyway, they denied that. They wanted me to get this thing down. So as I was going in, I got this lock on. And I had overtakes that were very high. But I was going 0.92 Mach, which is 92% of Mach 1, which is very fast, very close to 700 miles an hour. At any rate, when I locked on, that it was such a strong lock with strong information. I was getting all kinds of information from my radar. It was telling me everything. So I called Judy and started going in on the thing, and he still had to tell me some more. He said, straight ahead, just keep going, you're on the way. I said, I know that. Anyway, when I got my 20 seconds to go, the circle starts shrinking. On the circle, you have overtake speed. The overtake was indicating I was going 0.92, and this thing was probably pretty near still because he wasn't moving, because it was about that much closure speed. As I was getting closer, I noticed that my radar was basically so damn strong that I could see all the lights that were coming on, and what was going on was he had decided to get the hell out of there, and when he got out of there, he went Mach 10 or something. Was beyond anything I could measure. So, I mean, he left me just standing there, and he was gone. And this happened in maybe 1 or 2 seconds. And you know, at my speed, there's nothing I could do. That was it. It was all over for me. I talked to all the radar people. I said, GCI? I said, what's happening with Bogey? He said, I'm sorry, sir, but he's off our screen. He has a 250-mile range scope, and he was already off of their screen as well. So, there's nothing I can do. I can't do anything except fire rockets and then they'll land on Ipswich, and I don't want to do anything like that. So he said, well, you're released to home plate, meaning I could go home. On the way home, they called me and said, when you get on the ground, call me on the landline. I've got to give you a briefing. I said, Roger, I'd like to know what the hell happened too. So anyway, I got on the ground. I called them at this med sector was RAF control. This is the MOD that called the shots. And at any rate, they said, this mission has been declared top secret, and you're not to mention this to anyone, not your commander, not your wife, not anybody. Mum's the word. You didn't fly this mission. You understand? I said, yes, sir, I understand. He said, now, we're sending somebody down from the embassy to debrief you. What they meant is they're sending me a spook. A spook is what we used to call these people that come from the cloak and dagger and debrief you and, you know, tell you that you're in jeopardy of anything if you do anything. So when I got down there, the next morning, the spook showed up. I didn't see him. An innocent man that has been in contact with me since, because he didn't know about the mission either. But nobody knew about the mission until the MOD released it in October 21st of last year. When they released it, it just took all the weight off my shoulder. And now I could talk to anybody. So I talked to Ron Kane, who's an enlisted man. He was one of two twins. One of them passed away. Both of them were in our operations. And he said, "Hey, I took that guy back to you." I said, "I didn't know anybody knew about him. He came and went like a smoke. You know, like nobody saw him." So he said, "Yeah, I saw him. I can tell you all you want to know about him." I said, "I want to know where he was from." He said, "We don't know." Thank you very much. But I knew when he held up that USA document that he had, that it was the American Eagle, and it was that I should shut up. And he told me, "This is not only top secret. If you open your mouth about this to anyone, whether it be your commander or anyone else, we will take you away from flying for the rest of your career." And I just couldn't see that. So I jammed my two lips together and never said another word. And I left Manston. All my fighter buddies would love to have heard the story. And I would love to have told them, but I couldn't tell them. So I never said another word until the MOD has released it. Now I can talk to them about it. About time. That was the end of my mission. That was the end of my... But I'm going to tell you right now, I have convinced myself that this was an alien spacecraft, because he did things that my airplane couldn't do or no other airplane could do. And he had speeds that were infinite compared to what I could handle. And I think he had a propulsion system that was controlled anti-gravity or something, because he just took off. I don't know how the hell he did it without being plastered up against the ceiling, because there were G-forces going on there that I couldn't even imagine. So I have been convinced since then that was an alien, and nobody's going to talk me out of that one. I did it myself. And I thank you for your...
Ladies and gentlemen, I really don't know how you can follow an account like that. You have just been privileged to sit through a first-person description of arguably one of the most interesting UFO cases that I've ever heard about. 1957, bear in mind we're talking about. A radar return showing a craft the size of an aircraft carrier, capable of hovering at one moment and then accelerating away at speeds of Mach 10 at the next. I sure as heck don't know what that could be. It certainly wasn't one of ours. I wish it was.
Yeah, that's a great accounting. I came across this article. I posted on galacticroundtable.org. And it is a much more in-depth description from Major Torres about what happened that day, written by a guy in the UK. It's a very good article. So if you found that story interesting, you can go read that, and there's some pictures in there. So today I want to change it up a little bit. I'm not going to do the usual. I found, you know, the reason why we're doing this series with all the witnesses is because it's very important that we grasp the gravity of how the truth embargo affects all the other maladies that are plaguing Earth right now, like mass starvation and world war. And we have to think about the military, pharmaceutical, academia complex and all the money that's being made from the secret space program, from defense, intelligence, Pentagon, and the private sector. And that with the release of the technologies of propulsion fuel instead of petroleum, and the free energy technologies that will free up us using utilities and take us off of oil. A lot of powerful people with a lot of money don't want to see disclosure happen. And that's why I want everyone to get their link so they can watch the citizens' hearing on disclosure and be witness to it. So instead of the regular programming I do each day, today what I want to do is I'd like you to hear this interview by Jim Mars. He is a New York Times bestselling author and also a journalist. He's interviewing Dr. Stephen Greer. And the reason I like this interview and I want to present it to you is because it talks about these important points. Instead of speaking about what's happening with the UFO conspiracy, it's talking about the points of why it's important that we reveal this and we end the truth embargo. And this is a great presentation. So enjoy this.
My name is Jim Mars. I'm a journalist from Texas. I have a degree in journalism. I work for a number of Texas newspapers, even tried owning a couple. The problem is, as I got into more and more controversial and exotic subjects, I found myself a journalist without a journal. There is definitely very tight control over the flow of information in certain topics through our corporate control mass media. They seem to take it upon themselves to be the gatekeepers of information. Part of this information that they are keeping from us is the just absolutely immense wealth of information concerning the UFO phenomena and the fact that it can be tracked and documented all the way back through history, all the way back to the Bible with Ezekiel and the flaming wheel in the air, you know, flying through the sky. Hello. And so it's been with us all along. The problem has been since the early 50s, and I have the government documents. The United States government has instituted a policy of denial and control over the information. Nothing happening there, folks. Nothing happening there, folks. And if somebody persists in saying, but I saw it, then they're ridiculed. Oh, they've got a screw loose. Something's not right with them. And I think this is absolutely just unconscionable in a country that pays lip service to freedom and individual liberty, because there have been so many people whose lives have been wrecked, whose families have been wrecked because of this policy of denial and ridicule over a phenomena that has happened worldwide for centuries. It's just something that we're in denial about, pushed along by this government program. But the good news is it's starting to crack apart, okay? Thanks primarily to other countries. A couple of years ago, France, although it was not an official government report, many French government officials and military people participated in the Cometa report, and their conclusion was that UFOs are real, they represent visitation from another world. In England, for example, top government officials have acknowledged that we are being visited by craft from somewhere else and that there are people not from this planet. And what was really interesting, and I think should serve as a template for how to handle these things, was a little more than a year ago in Mexico, the defense minister actually handed over to the national media gun camera film from fighter interceptors that were using infrared. And although they didn't see anything, it picked up, I think, six or so UFOs, trailing them and moving around in an intelligently guided manner. Now, this is the type of openness. This is the type of let's share information with the public, let's find out what's going on, that is sadly lacking in the United States. But I think because of this increasing openness in other countries, we're now seeing this wall of censorship cracking apart in the United States. Just recently, we had a major TV network special, and I found it absolutely amazing because Peter Jennings of ABC flat, just very matter-of-factly, told a national audience that the Robinson panel of the 50s and the Operation Blue Book, Project Blue Book of the 60s were not really scientific-based investigations. They were just public relations efforts to try to get people not to be thinking about UFOs. So in other words, all you folks out there who are old enough to have been seen all the newspaper reports on the Robinson panel and hear what Blue Book said, it's just hogwash. Never mind. It's amazing. And but this seems to be the way. This is the way the status quo protects itself. They just can't allow information to come out overnight so people would be perturbed and actually demand that something be done about it. They stonewall it, deny it, lie about it for, you know, 30, 40 years, and then finally just announce it as if it's fact, and everybody goes, yeah, okay, because they already knew this anyway. In fact, this network special, it, to my mind, was reminded me of the old line about, hey, wait for me, I'm your leader. Okay? They did some pretty good jobs of detailing some of the major recent UFO things in the United States, the Phoenix flyover and the policeman chasing this thing through Missouri. But this was all years later. My immediate thought was, and they were interviewing the people involved. They were showing, you know, reenactments and recreations of what had gone on, and it was pretty compelling. But why didn't they tell us that when it happened? Isn't that what the news media is supposed to be doing? And so it's really funny. But it's also sad, but it's also encouraging because this wall of science is cracking open. Now, let me explain to you why this wall of science has been there. It's not that they really care that we know that aliens and ETs exist. What you have to understand is the United States government, the leader of the free world, is totally controlled by a wealthy oligarchy, a small handful of people that are just super rich. Most of them are not even in government, but they tell the government what to do. These are the people who are behind the UFO secrecy. They don't care if you know there's ETs out there. But if you know there's ETs out there, then you will know that there is alternative technology. And this could upset their monopolies over energy, fuel, transportation, communications, pharmaceuticals. And that's what they don't want. After all, who would continue to pay all these ever-increasing prices for gasoline that's polluting the air, choking us all, killing our kids? Why would we do that if we knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that there was non-polluting energy sources out there? This is what it's all about. It comes back to the old journalistic adage, follow the money. The study of UFOs, or ufology as they sometimes call it, I have watched with great interest how that has progressed over the years. Back in the 50s, the big question was, do they come from Mars or do they come from Venus? And by the 60s and 70s, we had gotten a little more sophisticated in our intellect and our thinking, and the question became, well, do they come from Alpha Centauri or Zeta Reticula 4, you know? Well, and then now we're up to today, and we've got even more sophisticated, and now the question is, do they come from another planet, or do they come from another dimension? Or are they perhaps time travelers? Do they come from another time, okay? And in my study of all of this, I have kind of come to the conclusion that the answer is yes. All of the above. I think that there are various groups, individuals, species, who from time to time come and visit this planet, zoop around. And I think that to try to ascribe any one particular motive to them is tantamount to us looking up at the air at a Boeing 767 aircraft and saying, are those people good or bad? You know, you just can't ask that. It's just, it's a group of people, a group of intelligent beings. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. But I will say this, I don't think there's any reason for great fear and anxiety, because the historical record is plain. This has been a phenomenon that's been around since our recorded history. The Vedas, the Hindu Vedas, which are among the oldest writings in the world, talk about the flying Bahamas and how that they were used to launch weapons and blow up cities and all this stuff. You know?
Love animals? Crave adventure. Want more wildlife than just taking Rover to the dog park? Well, have we got a gig for you. Mutual of Omaha is launching a YouTube video contest to find our new wild guy. What's a wild guy? Well, it's kind of like a rock star of the wild kingdom.
Oh, dear.
You'll be featured in online webisodes where you'll take viewers on amazing adventures. Oh, and if you would...
Sorry about that, everybody.
Again, we've got Ezekiel, and it just goes all the way back. So they've been here all along. If their game plan was like an Independence Day type invasion where they're going to blow up everything and eat everybody or whatever, it would have happened long before now. If their purpose was to invade the Earth, it would have happened in 1947, when all we had to resist them would have been propeller-driven airplanes and machine guns. And now we have, you know, laser technology, scalar weapons, electromagnetic beam weapons, space platforms, and they still haven't done it. So I don't think there's any reason at all for a lot of fear and hysteria. So what is the agenda? What is the alien agenda, which was the title of my UFO book? I think that, let me put it this way. Back in the early 90s, they were clearing some rainforest in Brazil, and they came across the Caribo tribe, which was a Stone Age, still living in the Stone Age. Now, in years past, we were so sociologically primitive that we would have just rushed in there and said, here's some clothes, put them on, here's some Bibles, get religion, here's a gun, you know, you can hunt, and we would have essentially destroyed their culture. This time, we were a little bit more sociologically advanced. They actually quarantined the area, not to keep them in, but to keep others out. And then they formed a team of scientists, anthropologists, and sociologists, and they had a pool, and they sent these scientists down there, and they conditioned this tribe to their presence. They let themselves be seen from a far distance up on a hillside or something, and they kind of waved to them, you know, and then after some days went by, they would get a little closer, and finally they'd be just across the clearing from them, and they'd hold their hands up, and they'd wave, and they'd show that they were non-hostile, non-threatening, until finally they made contact with the tribe. And even at that point, what they wanted to do was study the tribe to find out what Stone Age societies live like. And I think about the only thing, they did go so far as to give them some metal knives to make their life a little bit easier, you know. And you can imagine that these people went, wow, a steel knife. You know, this is magic, okay. The purpose of that story is that they were conditioned to accept this highly technological advanced race, which is us. I feel we have been undergoing a similar conditioning program since at least the 1940s to condition us to accept the reality of the extraterrestrial presence. And it's been quite successful. Polls in the United States in the 1950s showed virtually no one believed that there was any life outside the Earth. And yet today, and if I'm not mistaken, I think Peter Jennings said that their polls show something like 85% now say, yes, I believe there is life outside this planet. So we are getting very close, I feel, to actually breaking this whole thing open and accepting the reality of life outside this planet. When I was a youngster in school, we were told the moon was just a dead world, just a rock Nothing there. And now we're being told, well, there is a little thin atmosphere and there's winds that blow across the moon. And, oh, yeah, we found water on the moon. And the same thing's happening with Mars. Oh, that was a dead world. Oh, well, we did find these polar caps. Yeah, it was probably frozen methane. No, now we find it's water. And now we find there's an underground lake on Mars that's got all, you know, something tells me they probably found some sort of primitive life. They just haven't announced it yet, but they will. And we're being slowly conditioned to understand that there is life outside this planet and that we probably live in a universe and a galaxy teeming with life. Now, so what is their purpose? They are conditioning us to understand this because I feel like that, like in Star Trek, there is a prime directive. Now, I'm unclear on whether this is a law with enforcement capabilities or simply a general understanding, but it is a thought held by all of the thinking beings in the universe that it is not proper to interfere with God's natural evolution of the species. So they are prohibited, either self-control or by maybe some imposed law, from directly impacting on us and directly contacting us and giving us weapons, giving us technology that would interrupt our natural evolution. But yet I think especially because of the onset of the whole UFO phenomena beginning about 1946-47, and that I don't think it's coincidence that that coincided with our development of nuclear weapons. And I think that out in the universe, they thought they were horrified. They said, oh my God, the kids have found the matches. Well, they don't want us to destroy ourselves, and they don't want us to destroy this planet. And yet they're prohibited from directly intervening in our affairs and in our evolution. So I think that we've got crop circles and animal mutilations and abductions and sightings and increasing sightings and all like that, so that it's not directly impacting on us. And yet over this conditioning period, we are coming to understand that we're not the only ones in the universe. And I think they're trying to kind of boost us up the evolutionary ladder so that we can grow to be full members of the intergalactic community instead of destroying ourselves through our petty bickering wars and nuclear holocaust. And that is the human, the alien agenda. Recently, I completed a documentary on one of the most fascinating investigations that I've ever been involved in my years as a journalist. It involves an area east of the little town of Deer Lodge, Montana, known as Red Gate. And this was named after a gate that at one point had been painted red, but it mostly faded, but it was known as Red Gate. This was the teenage parking spot. This is where you would take your date to go up in the mountains and park. And it already had a legend for being a spooky and creepy place. In fact, an urban legend grew up about it that the gate was red because somebody murdered his entire family and smeared their blood on the gate. Well, we went up to Deer Lodge. One of the first people I talked to was the sheriff. And he confirmed that there had been no murder up in this area. So the story of the murder and the blood on the gate was just an urban legend. But then he himself said, but he had had lots of reports of strange activity in this area and that it mostly concerned UFOs. And then he gave us the names of some people in town, including the local baker, Louis Maticucci. And Louis and his family had lived up in this Red Gate area, and they had some wild stories of seeing these ships that would rise up out off the mountain at night, of animal mutilations. His own dog had a huge piece taken off of his back, and when they took him to the vet, they couldn't even sew it together because it was so wide. They wouldn't know what happened to the rest of the hide, and this happened twice. So some neighbors had animal mutilations, and it was quite incredible. And so we began to dig into this little town, and we found that in this one small little American town of 3,000 people, within a week and a half, we'd gotten more than 30 signed releases from people who said they had had ongoing UFO experiences dating all the way back to 1950. Now, that's amazing. And it prompted me to wonder how many other towns in America have had this similar situation, but nobody wants to talk about it. And again, because of the denial and ridicule factor. But the thing that I think was most fascinating about the investigation of Redgate, and that I think people should pay attention to, because I think this may give you the methodology for looking into these stories. If you have someone who says, I was abducted and they floated me through the window and I went up in a ship and they took me here and they probed me and they, et cetera, et cetera, that's interesting, but it's just a narrative. And your choice is, do you believe this person or do you not? And of course, this leads to the big controversy over the abductions, because some people say, well, I believe them. Others said, no, I don't believe them. You know, they're making it up or they're daydreaming or whatever. Well, we set about to try to find out what really happened. And there was a fellow named Bill Kelly. All he remembered consciously was that as a young teenager, he was with his brother and another guy. They were driving down a dark road late at night, and this light chased him. And I said, well, you know, what happened to it? He said, well, it just went away. All right. We subjected him to polygraph, the lie detector test. Everyone we had take the lie detector showed no signs of deception. So everybody was telling what at least they believed to be the truth. Bill Kelly, no exception. Then we set him down, got his conscious recollection. Yeah, this light came, and it was really strange, and we were freaking out, and it just went away. Then we put him under hypnosis, and we get more details. We find out, no, it didn't just go away. It hovered over the car. They stopped the car. His friends were saying, don't get out, don't get out, but he got out, okay? But then he got very emotional, and he got very hesitant. And that's about all we could learn under the hypnosis. So then we turned to the CIA-tested and Army-used techniques of remote viewing. We had 8 remote viewers who took a look at this, and one of them pretty well typified what they found was, because they drew a car, they drew a big saucer-shaped object with a cone and these 3 guys rising up through the cone. They had been taken up on the ship. But they had had their memories of this wiped. Okay, so that was one. I think the most miraculous thing, and I have to tell you this because it will give you a good example of the power and the penetration investigative technique of remote viewing. One of the stories involved a young boy and his sister. And the young boy, who of course is now a middle-aged man, consciously remembers going outside of their ranch home near Deer Lodge into the woods and visiting their little gray friends. His sister did not remember this consciously, but under hypnosis, she too talked of going into the woods and visiting with their little gray friends. Polygraph showed no signs of deception, so we get to the remote viewing. The question was, what really happened to these kids in 1950? So that question was put to an administrator who then attached that question to a number, a 2-4-digit number, an 8-digit number that represented the question. What happened to these kids? He takes the number, just the number, and turns it over to a tasker. The tasker has no idea of what this is all about, what the question is, what the context is. He simply has the number, which he passes to a monitor. The monitor has no idea what the question is, what the topic is, what anything is about this. He only knows their target is this number. He then takes the number and passes it to 8 separate remote viewers who live in different cities and different states. This was all done by email and telephone. When they have the opportunity, they sit down and they do a remote viewing. All of them were trained and certified by some of the military-trained remote viewers. They have a track record. We know these are good, tested remote viewers. They sit down and they look at the target. All they have is this number. That's their target. Go look at this. What's this? Okay. and they mentally focus and they go to the target, and all eight then send their raw data back in to the monitor, who sends it to the tasker, who summarizes things and sends it back to the administrator, and then we get our response back. Now, they all saw some different aspect of this, but it blew me away. All eight essentially said these were two small children who went in the woods near their home and met with aliens. It's just astounding. I mean, even if that's some sort of a made-up thing, even if they're reading minds or something, you know, that's just as extraordinary as the fact that they're able to go and use a number to go to this particular event and that eight separate people agree on what happened in that event. So I'm hoping that this type of methodology to be used in investigations of this type will become, you know, a template for the use in the future to investigate such stories.
Dr. Greer now. This is just a kind of a segue thing we're doing.
Secrecy has invaded, like a cancer, many institutions, including the media, government, corporations. This is a lot of things people don't understand. I mean, I have personally briefed members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, members of the Joint Staff, the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States, the head of the Ministry of Defense in Great Britain, our CIA director under Clinton. And what I found was that most of the people in government that you and I would normally think would know about these sort of clandestine issues were being lied to or kept out of the loop. And so that there's this rogue, very well-funded transnational group that's highly corporatized, privatized, that is running this. It is not, people say, the government's keeping this secret. I said, the government knows very little. The government of we the people. There are a few people in the government who know, and those control points are lying to their colleagues. For example, there are a few people in the in Congress and Senate who know about this, but they do not tell their colleagues. And so it's a very dangerous project in the sense that it has subverted the U.S. Constitution, the British rule of law. If you go all over the world, sort of highly organized group that is running projects related to UFOs, and they're quite developed, are operating outside the rule of law of any country. And that is dangerous because they're sitting on information and, more importantly, technologies. One of the things we found, for example, is that beginning in the 30s and 40s, certainly by the 50s, we were studying the modus operandi. I'm quoting from a top secret Canadian document. the Wilbur Smith document from 1951, which I'm sure you've seen, has this statement that by that time, there was a high-profile group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who headed up the Manhattan Project, to look into how these things were operating. And by the mid to late 50s, we had figured out the energy and propulsion systems behind so-called anti-gravity, extracting energy from the fabric of space so you don't have a fuel to carry. And that once they realized what this was and that it would be a threat to the big corporate kleptocracy that runs the world, big oil, fossil fuels, centralized utilities, centralized economies, that they put the lid on this and took it out of the supervision even of the U.S. president and most members of Congress and the British prime minister and et cetera and so on. Most high officials in the Pentagon know very little about this subject because I have been the person to brief them. And the ones who do know are part of this conspiracy of silence, for lack of a better word, to cooperate to keep this stuff very secret. The secrecy isn't because people are afraid that they're going to find out that there's life in the universe. It's because if it's confirmed that these UFOs are real, and they are, with it will become an immediate question by the scientific community, well, how are they operating? And when that gets asked, we have people who can answer it. And when that gets answered, it's the end of big oil. It's the end of coal. It's the end of centralized electric utilities. And it's the biggest change in the global macroeconomic order since the Industrial Revolution of the mid-1800s. That's what we're dealing with. The secrecy is clearly related to that.
Have you ever thought about this, you guys? Have you ever thought about never paying your electric bill again? Never paying your heating bill? Your natural gas bill? Or your fuel bill for the house? How much more would you gain per year? Wonder what you could do with that money. Multiply that around the world. That's a chunk of change. I mean, I really want people to grasp why they're holding on to this. Thanks.
Anything else? It's all about power, geopolitical power, and centralized power. A lot of people don't realize there's about 250 integrated corporations and individuals in the world that control virtually all of the world economy. And they're all interrelated. They're vertically and horizontally integrated. And their interests in this are profound. I remember Lawrence Rockefeller when I was out at his ranch. And, of course, he had hosted President Clinton and his wife, Hillary Clinton, for a couple years during their vacations in August during his presidency. And they were out there, actually, because we were doing briefings. I was putting together big briefing documents, and Lawrence Rockefeller was sort of a mediator providing information to them. And, you know, I was at his ranch out in the Tetons once, and he turned to me. He said, Dr. Greer, you know, no aspect of life on Earth will be untouched by this information coming out so vast and so profound are the implications. I said, I know, Mr. Rockefeller. That's why it's been kept secret. It's not because it's a silly thing. Now, what the controllers, the disinformation controllers, want the public to believe is that it's about silly stuff like, oh, you know, an alien took me on board a spaceship and I have a baby floating in an incubator around Alpha Centauri, what I call the silly season of all this. And that disinformation is put out there through the UFO subculture, through the media, through documentary makers, through filmmakers who don't know the difference between information and disinformation. 90% of everything on this subject is disinformation, designed to do two things. Either engender fear, because it's very frightening information, which shuts people down, or to make it look silly and absurd so that serious scientists, policymakers, intellectuals, and academics will just dismiss it out of hand. And it's been done consistently since the 40s and 50s. And I have documents that prove that this is the case. I have a CIA document stating, this is in the 1950s, that this is a subject for the use of psychological warfare techniques, psyops. And that is true. And so it's something where the public, for the most part, is greatly disinformed deliberately. You know, not just misinformed, but disinformed. What the Disclosure Project is trying to do is, by referring to people who've had firsthand involvement with these projects, plus our own firsthand research, real-time research, is to put together the assessments of what's going on. And we feel this is important to share that with the president or members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, as it is with the general public, because contrary to what the public would think on something this sensitive, most people in government, even high officials in government, if they even know this could be true, if they make an inquiry about it, this happened to President Carter, it happened to President Clinton, it's happened to many high officials, they are basically told, we're not going to tell you. Sometimes they'll just be denied that it exists at all, but sometimes they will flat out say, we're not going to tell you. I'll give you an example. In the late 1990s, after I had briefed members of Congress on this problem, I was invited to do a stand-up briefing at the Pentagon for the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's called J2. And this admiral, I had provided, and in our book Disclosure, which you can get at the website disclosureproject.org, we have a document that actually is from the 90s, early 90s, that lists code names and project names and code numbers that were authentic and legitimate as of that time dealing with this issue. I gave this to the admiral's point of contact to us. He looked into it. He actually found one of those compartmented secret cells in the Pentagon. He called them and said, I want to be read into or briefed on this project. And they said, sir, you don't have a need to know. This is the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, we're not talking about some low-level munchkin out here. Now, what that means is that you have a complete decapitation of the constitutional leadership. And it also means that it's very important for us to try to identify intelligence sources who are courageous enough to come forward and speak the truth and put that information out to the public. Because I think nothing less than the future of planet Earth is hanging in the balance. And we're not talking just about whether or not people know there are UFOs. We're talking about what are we going to do about the fact that we're about to reach peak oil. What are we going to do with the fact that we have global warming and both polar ice caps are melting? What are we going to do about the fact that there is this increasing concentration of wealth in a few hands, but increasing poverty around the world that's engendering terrorism and hatred and conflict? All these are trend lines that can be corrected by this information and these technologies coming out. It's not just information. It's about the fact that there are seriously important technologies that would give us an entirely new sustainable civilization that are being kept secret because letting them out makes redundant and obsolete the $100 to $200 trillion oil and coal and fossil fuel piggy bank that these groups are sitting on. Well, the Disclosure Project is a worldwide effort to identify military and government and some corporate insiders who've had personal knowledge of extraterrestrial or UFO or advanced propulsion related systems that have been kept secret for at least 50 or 60 years. The Disclosure Project's oriented towards putting together credible government documents and these witnesses so that there is an
Mayor Kane cannot have such unchecked power.
Things are falling through.
Undeniable case made that this is real and not fictitious. It started really in early 1990s, and after I had briefed the President Clinton's first CIA director on this problem, it was made very clear to me that the executive branch of the U.S. government did not want to do this because, I'm quoting, the president was concerned he would end up like Jack Kennedy. I'm not kidding. That was said to me by President Clinton's closest friend. So what we decided to do was to take this on ourselves and initially put this information in the hands of members of Congress to see if they would hold open hearings. And when they chose not to, by 98, we decided to do this ourselves. And so the Disclosure Project was an outgrowth of our identifying the intelligence sources and the evidence and then putting it through the system of government to give the government of we the people the opportunity to do the right thing and end all the illegal secrecy and bring this information out. Since they did not have the courage to do so in 2001, about 4 years ago, we decided to go ahead and do that ourselves. And that since then, we have been putting this information out in the public domain. You know, our website's had over 10 million people on it. We have a Disclosure Project video that was the National Press Club event that's been seen by nearly 3 million people, which is quite a large number. And we just continue to put that information out through venues like this and speaking and what have you. We still would like to see the Congress take this on. But I think given the current governmental penchant for secrecy and supporting corporate illegal projects, it's unlikely that's going to happen. So I think it's really going to be in our laps. We, the people, are going to have to tell the truth. And so the Disclosure Project is a nonprofit effort to assemble the best possible witnesses and the best available evidence and put it out to the public and also to our leaders. We know people can see a lot of this at disclosureproject.org, which is our website, and we have over 450 military and intelligence witnesses. They range from generals and brigadier generals to air traffic controllers and strategic air command personnel in the Air Force to civilian people in the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, to astronauts and cosmonauts. And it's an enormous database of people who have up close and personally seen UFOs or worked in those projects in their capacity as a government or military person. And many of them, most of them, had top secret clearances, some of them highly compartmented. And their information is really dispositive. We have enormous documentation that is corroborated by multiple people. For example, when I said, let's see what the Strategic Air Command and what the interest has been in these extraterrestrial vehicles for nuclear, seeing what we're doing with nuclear weapons, we decided not to identify one or two, but we have like a couple dozen of those people who were in Strategic Air Command, who were in nuclear facilities, who were in the old Atomic Energy Commission, like Colonel Diedrichsen that we have as a witness, who had personal knowledge of the fact that even though there's clearly no evidence, I want to emphasize this, that these extraterrestrial civilizations are hostile towards us, I think they're very worried about our hostility. I always turn this on its head because most of these sort of documentaries are always like alien invasion and all this stuff. No. The issue is that, you know, if they were hostile, we would know it by now. It's clear to me that what's going on is that they're very concerned that at the time that humanity reached the ability to go into space, early space exploration, 50s, we also had already developed weapons of mass destruction and thermonuclear and hydrogen bombs and stuff. And that the coincidence of that, the coming together of those two things, put a big red flag over Earth. And so if you look at the databases from the 50s, 60s, 70s on forward, not only in the United States, but in Great Britain, in the Soviet Union, China, that wherever we had space, aerospace, and nuclear facilities, there were a lot of these so-called UFOs being seen. And it makes sense because it's a very short distance from where we are now to being able to go further out in the space with these kinds of aggressive tendencies. And one of the things I point out to people is that our social and spiritual development appears to have lagged behind our technological prowess, and our technological capacities are actually, at this point, a threat to perhaps the cosmic order, if you will. So we have really determined that these witnesses that have been in these projects have enormous insight into what's actually happened. And it's not only their testimony, but it also can put together a mosaic going all the way back to the 40s and 50s. We have, for example, a brigadier general who had worked as an aide to President Eisenhower, who saw how Eisenhower was very interested in all this, but was being left out of this decision-making process, that he'd lost control of these projects. That's as clear as I can explain it to people as to why the secrecy exists and why we have decided, I'm an emergency physician, I've left my position as a doctor to do this pro bono for free because I feel it's so important that this information get out to the public and as quickly as possible. We have a term called fast walkers that's been used from people who have been at the NORAD. That have tracked these objects in near-Earth space. Actually, that term was used in the 60s and 70s. The National Security Agency actually for a long time had called these ETVs, extraterrestrial vehicles. The word UFO is actually a disinformation term that was invented after they knew that they weren't unidentified and they knew they didn't fly. So it's sort of a mind play. The fast walkers are these very rapid-moving electrogravitic and anti-gravity disks and craft of various shapes that are tracked on classified tracking systems, both in their deep space network and also in the atmosphere. We have more than one witness who have been involved in the tracking of these objects on radar. You know, many people say, well, look, if this stuff was real, why are there no radar reports? I said, we have them. We actually have the radar tapes from the FAA. So we have people from the FAA and from the military who have tracked these objects. And they've been called fast walkers because, as opposed to slow walkers, which are satellites, because they move at enormous speeds. For example, they've been tracked at going tens of thousands of miles per hour in the atmosphere and make a right-hand turn without decelerating. Well, you can't do that with a conventional system. You have to correct for gravity and mass inertia. And that's what these things are doing. So these have been tracked on dedicated and classified radar systems. Occasionally, people who are on an ordinary system will pick them up, although the modern radar systems are designed to filter those out. Well, the thing I would have people look at, if they really wanted to find out, I think they need to look at these firsthand top secret witnesses and what they've seen. I think that if you go to the civilians, it's a whole gamish of misinformation, disinformation, and amateur hour. What we've tried to do is professionalize the effort, and people really need to look. I mean, if somebody who had the clearance to carry nuclear weapons or launch nuclear weapons saw these objects over a nuclear facility and reported it and have documents to prove it happened, this is dispositive. That's what someone who is wanting to look into this, who says, well, could this really be true and I don't know about it, they need to look at that. And we've assembled it. We have a 600-page book of top secret documents and the transcripts of these witnesses. We have videotapes. We have a 4-hour tape. We have a 2-hour tape. We have a 1-hour tape. And our website, disclosureproject.org, actually has a lot of this information and the testimony on there. I think that's what people need to look at, and it's the weight of the evidence. But if you wanted to look at one case, for example, that would be dispositive. Look at what the third highest ranking member of the FAA, John Callahan, brought to us. This man, during the Reagan years, was in charge of accidents and investigations for the FAA, the United States Federal Aviation Administration. He was called into a case, which is the Japan Airlines case over Alaska, where an extraterrestrial vehicle the size of a huge ship was being tracked on military radar, civilian radar, and onboard a 747's onboard radar for a prolonged period of time. This was given back to him. He did an analysis of the data. He determined that it was a real structured object moving at enormous and unusual velocities. In fact, it would be one point in the sky and then instantly would be in another place 40, 50 miles away. And this thing was the size, that he said, of a destroyer, a battleship. Big, huge. It wasn't like 30 feet around. It was hundreds of feet. And this was seen by the pilot. We have the pilot's report. We have the original radar tapes and the digital reports, this thick of a report. He was called in to do a briefing for Ronald Reagan's science advisor, people from the CIA and FBI. At the end of that meeting, they turned to him and they said, you were not at this meeting. This event didn't happen, and we're confiscating all this stuff. What they didn't know is that they confiscated duplicates. He kept the originals, and when he retired, he gave them to us. This man's name is John Callahan. We have his name, address, a phone number. We have all this evidence. That's one case. So, I mean, and it's dispositive. And the question is, if you have one case like that, it proves it. But we have hundreds of cases like that. So I would say to people, look at the evidence. The evidence is there. Now, the big question is, why doesn't the masses of people know about it? The only institution that is more corrupt than what I'm describing as this rogue transnational kleptocracy is the major media. More worse than the Congress, worse than the White House, worse than anything at the normal level of clearances at the Pentagon is big media. Big media does not report the truth about these things because they are not free to. And we think in the United States and in the Western world, we really have a free press. We have a free press on everything that's not important. On the really important issues, it's very controlled. And this is the most important issue. This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government. And they have cooperated with keeping the secret. And that's why it's very important, but to use every venue we can to get the information out. Well, actually, there's been a lot of coverage of what we're doing in the media superficially. And let me give you an example. ABC News and other major networks were at the Disclosure Project National Press Club event about 4 years ago. The executive producer for ABC News told me they wanted to do a very big expose on this through Primetime Live or 2020. I said, we'll give you everything. So we gave him literally, you know, the sort of distilled 35 hours of digital videotape of these witnesses and all our documents so he could do this. And carte blanche access to all these top secret witnesses.
This book is pure sophistication.
There you go.
He called me a couple weeks later and said, well, they won't let me do this. I said, who's they? He says, well, Dr. Greer, you know who they are.
It was brought out in other interviews that the they they're talking about is David Rockefeller.
And so the people, the corporate bosses who answer to some of these transnational financial and other interests were basically killed the project. We've seen this happen over and over again. And so you can get a certain amount of information out through the large media, but it's very superficial, very brief. That's what we found. The in-depth sort of disclosure, what's really going on, who's behind it, what the agenda is, that is almost always stopped. Or if they try to do it, it gets turned into something ridiculous. Like what Peter Jennings did last year on ABC News. It was absurd. I mean, there have been better things done on inexpensive cable channels. So my point is that the media people, the rank and file, are often very interested. But then from somewhere deeper and higher than they are, it gets killed if they try to do anything in-depth. So that's what we have found. And so the in-depth information, I think we have to put out through the internet, through other documentaries, and through other means. Maybe eventually there will be a media interest that is large media that will do a true expose of this. We stand ready to work with anyone who is willing to do that. And we certainly have the evidence to do it. The central point I'd like to communicate to people is that we all have a responsibility to find out what the truth is about something like this. And it is, people have to take responsibility for looking into what the truth is. We've put together the means for people to do that. Now people have to take the initiative. And we need all the help we can get. I would ask people to help us network this to anyone and any institution that can help. The reason this is so critical is that we've reached a point in our civilization where for us to go forward as a people, we're going to have to end this kind of illegal secrecy, and we're going to have to allow this information and these technologies to get out and begin to fix many of these large problems. The question of UFOs and extraterrestrials, most people just think is something entertaining. In reality, it's something that is central to how we're going to be able to go forward as a civilization, because that issue involves sciences, technologies, energy, and propulsion systems that could give us a whole new civilization. Imagine being able to run your house or your car or your business from an energy source that is non-polluting, doesn't connect to a central grid, does not use fossil fuels or nuclear power, and is extracting energy from what's called the space around us, the quantum vacuum space. That's what these technologies do. We, the taxpayers, have through our government and what's called the black budget, it's about $100 billion a year, put money that have gone into corporations like Lockheed, Northrop, SAIC, EG&G, Raytheon and E-Systems, okay, Atlantic Research Corporation, and those entities have these technologies. It's time for us to say we would like to have a dividend on that investment, and this information belongs to the people, the technologies belong to the people, and the Earth and all of humanity needs to have these technologies for peaceful energy generation.
Spread the word, everybody. This is the real message from Disclosure. We're going to free up the world to do what we're supposed to do. So please share the information widely. Get your access pass now for the citizens' hearing and be there either live or live stream. Thanks for all that you do, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hope you'll come see me tomorrow. Namaste.